Indian kingdom, which became prominent in the 2nd century BC, was created from their control of the trade routes. The trade routes extended from Kanna in the south up to Marib, from there to Mecca, Medina, Dijan, through Medin Saleh, which is in northwestern Saudi Arabia, on to Ayla, which is just at the mouth of the Red Sea, and then from Ayla on to Petra, and then from Petra to the north to Amman, the capital of Jordan, and from Amman to Damascus, which of course is the capital of Syria. But from Petra, trade routes also went through to the west, to Gaza, and to the Mediterranean. And the Nabataean control of the spices that were carried over this trade route were the origin of the wealth that they amassed during the 2nd century, the 1st century, and until actually Petra and the trade routes were so coveted by the Roman Empire that they were subsumed by the Romans in 106 AD or CD. And we can see how ideas came not only from the East and India, but also close association with Egypt. This is an aerial shot of the mountains around Petra. You can see that there is a natural chasm or declivity in the rock, which has been widened over the years by streams of water flow from the Wadi Musa into the center of the city. It is here that Indiana Jones and his father rode on horseback to find their way to the most illustrious monument known as the Khazneh. Now the Khazneh, which is also known as the treasury, is thought of as being sort of a perfect Hellenistic monument in the middle of Petra. But it has Nabataean overtones, that is for sure. What you don't see very well here is that the monument is unfinished. Extending from the second order roof, there would have been an obelisk on both sides. We call the second order, or upper order, you can see how the pediment of the temple is broken. This is characteristic of Nabataean architecture, taken from the Hellenistic world, but used by the Nabataeans, particularly in their monuments and their tombs. Is this a tomb? Probably. When was it built? Probably by Aretas IV, who was one of the great kings of Petra and is thought to have been the greatest builder of the city. So now these Nabataeans had amassed a tremendous amount of wealth. And what did they want to do? They wanted to show off. And they built incredibly large structures. This structure supposedly has the same dimensions as Westminster Abbey. You have to think of Indiana coming down through that chasm into the sunlight and seeing the cosmos. Petra has been excavated off and on over the years. And here is a map that is produced by Bachman, and it was also produced by Browning. You can see where Bachman thought a great temple to be. And you see the central street and then the Temenos area going into the Qasr al-Bint. I want to remind you, none of these structures actually exist, except for the Temenos and the Qasr al-Bint, which is one of the largest temples, as well as the Temple of the Winged Lions, which is right across the street from the Great Temple. The lower market, the middle market, the upper market have never been excavated. Only 1% of central Petra has been excavated. And this is why the Brown University excavations have been so important. In 1993, we took a group of aerial photographs. This is what the Great Temple in those days looked like from the air. Perhaps you can see the column fall from the front of the temple, but that's just about it. You can see how the land around the temple area has been built up over its 2,000 years of being buried. Now you can see the same area and what our excavations have produced. after 6 seasons of working at the Prey Temple, you can see that we have well-defined a mammoth structure, which is larger in its precinct than the custodial bench, which lies beside it. Adorning the lower temenos are as many as 120 columns, and these columns have elephant heads. They're not African elephants, they're Indian elephants. We've already noted obelisks being built into Pahasne. We've already noted Hellenistic ideas in the Hasne. And here we are with a freestanding building with elephant heads adorning the capitals of columns. Her Majesty Queen Noor came to visit us last year, and we were very grateful that she came and took such an interest in our excavations. She spent about an hour with us at
JD?
The place, and she had a lot of interest in what we were doing and how we were doing
JD?
It, and we were very grateful.
Can you hear us, JD? JD? Hello, JD. Did we lose you?
Hello.
JD?
I know.
JD? Can you hear us?
I think we got a feed from New York and it split us up, but it didn't split us up very well. JD, we're going to be back in a minute. See you in a minute.
George, where's Tusk?
He's getting food and...
Okay.
I have no idea.
Just water. Did you already? I'm sorry, on order. What? Yes, what? Yes, no. You meant to say yes, no. Yeah, I'll have water. My water's slowly percolating up.
It was perfect a minute ago, and then Brown University was giving us a lecture as they were, you know, for tape.
Yo, Brown.
Hello, Brown. Who all else is in?
Professor Vitalski is here. I am, and my boss.
How are you, Greg?
No, I'm not Greg.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who's that?
Here, guys. Hello.
This is Lenny. I'm Sarah.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. We're doing well in Athens here. It's later in the day. I suppose it's early there for you, huh?
Well, I thought you were back in Boston.
Not yet. I'm on my way this weekend.
All right.
seen everybody from the left hand side.
Mm-hmm.
And I roll the face, face them and see on the right hand side. And that's going to be the cue.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike, everything out there. Come to the end, I turn off all the mics, and I go back to the camera. It's a visual cue. More than anything else.
You come back
here
at the end?
Yes.
Now, what do I have to know? I have to look at this for what's going on.
Right.
And I just stand here and wait for somebody to ask me a question.
Right. You have to run for him, for him, for him, for him.
I put it on the mic.
And
I've got some filing I can do.
Right. But the clue is only thing I'm going to mic level for you. Put this on.
You're coming in very clearly here in Athens.
Instead,
what did I do today? I got up about a half, well, let's say, an hour and a half ago, and I answered 17 email messages. There you go.
Wow.
But none for sure.
I haven't bothered you in a while, have I?
Yes, then I made myself a cup of coffee, and I wish I brought a cup for you and for me, and for all of us. All right.
One last detail.
That's the actual camera that you're going to be using for. Did it get the sound of it?
Sure did.
It does?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah, very clearly. You're coming in great. By the way, the videotape came through wonderfully as well.
Good. Well, you can thank Leonardo.
Well, Leonardo, you've done a great job. Thank you so much for all your help, by the way.
Oh, no problem. No problem.
You want some photos collecting the files, and then these are the...
The camera system?
The photographic grid. And then
this is
the... Yes. And then more charge. You can choose whatever you want at the end.
That's a good shot. You can show that there are hand tools used, you know, the typical tools of the trade, which includes the modern devices plus a hammer.
Yeah, they're on the back, these are files as they were found in the
side. I like a beautiful shot, yeah.
And here you have
they're
not restored.
When you speak to them, this is the same thing. Never follow your speech. And you start from the beginning.
Yes.
This is. And we're going to have a map of
Greece.
In this island. You're getting it.
Oh.
And then you're going to show the location, which is marked on the map. Then the location, and then some of the underwater excavation and how it's done.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And that it's a deserted island, and that we've got a find that is important in its relevance because it was so common.
This is the oldest evidence we have. All the services are gone. Where the car was shit. It sank.
Yes, get it first. Brown is first. Mark Jakowski is the geologist for Brown University.
We have a friend who is teaching that he's worked with us in the course
of... Oh, really? A problem?
Yes.
Yes, we're an adaptable people.
We just start their life at 60.
They have to get it all before they die. Digital is ready, working.
Harvard University, how you doing? You in today? Bill Shea, 15. Professor Nod, say hello. New York, Denmark, South Carolina.
Because you've got Greece, and you can point out this is the, which
yes,
is here.
This is, yeah. This is the guy, like
right, right, right.
The smell of the lecture is the person.
It's relatively close. This is the Pelican East across
it's
the...
something yeah. Like yeah. 45, 50 miles from the port of Venus.
in that safe, looked like a safe little harbor. Hello, Jordan.
Isn't that pretty what you did?
Hello, Jordan. Okay.
Martha?
We hope to start at the appointed hour. We're still waiting for our friends from New York and Denmark and a few other places. We have Jordan up and running smoothly.
Right. I'm the
lover. Hello, Jordan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Now that you guys are here. We're very happy.
Hello.
Yes. How are you, Charles?
I'm all right. I postponed my surgery until Tuesday.
Oh, that's good news. Well, I guess.
Well, I guess, yeah.
Unless you're in pain.
No, I'm just taking a lot of penicillin.
Okay. Well, that's okay. You won't be talking today. Has David Manier made it over? Vanessa, you did it. Thank you, my friend.
Okay, that's Aman. That's Jubilee School in Jordan. That's out in the outskirts of Aman. Pretty. It's a good ride out of the center, but I'm in a nice area, on a hill. Oh, yeah, yeah. Really? I like it. Well, actually, it's pretty nice. Oh, yeah. It's really, playback, you can close that.
Hello,
who's saying hello?
Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. How you doing?
Your cell phone.
He's hiding back there.
Hi. Good morning.
That's Teresa.
Hi, Teresa.
Where are you, Paco?
Here I am. Lots of love to you. Can't you see me?
Welcome to Athens. I apologize for the view.
Only Stasi can do that. Nobody else.
We dressed like twins today.
Teresa, me si levi, ya ti me pio oreos.
Is that great for that other man?
What
do you want?
Oh, well, that's a different
Watch out.
Where's your pen?
It should be right there.
γιατί κάτω μας το έκαλε με ένα παιχνίδι μεγάλο για να με χαρούμε. Εγώ είμαι τώρα, εντάξει! Θα γιορτάσουμε όταν γυρίσετε.
You have to translate for the New York kids now.
New York, this is all good for you, I know, but that's what open is all about. It's about learning, experiencing new things in life. So it's never too late to learn Greek.
Or Arabic, or Danish.
Or Danish.
The internet will breathe new life into your language. I just know it.
I know. Great. Don't forget, America, Philadelphia is Greek.
Philadelphia was the capital of Amman, what is now Amman, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I love 384. Everybody, sing it. South Carolina, are you around? Jed, you made it to work yet? How about Denmark? Hello, Denmark. Lars, you there?
Θανάση, τα κατάφερες. Μπράβο, συγχαρητήρια. Congratulations.
Wonderful job. I knew you guys could do it.
I hope Altec gives you a raise. Is Κυριάκος there to hear that?
Well, it's on tape.
I'm trying to get that way there.
New York, can you say hello?
Hello.
Who's there?
George.
Hello, Charles.
Charles and Rothstein are over at Washington Irving.
Great.
I don't see Humanities up yet, but they tend to be a little bit of sleepyheads.
Yes.
I called them yesterday, George, as I said to you on the phone to be there by 7:30. I've got about 7:22 today.
That's my time here. Well, I'm the 22 past the hour here in Greece as well. So they've got a few minutes before we scold them, virtually. South Carolina, are you in? Jed, South Carolina, Britain's next. Are you in with us today? JD, any luck with South Carolina? JD, how goes Command and Control Center? We want Gada from Denmark. Gada, we need you to speak Arabic. I hope you're there. We need some translation.
One of our students from Denmark is actually from Lebanon, and I'm not sure what she's
doing. Did she learn Arabic?
Yeah, she spoke Arabic for our students, and
morning. Are we receiving?
Yes, you are. You're being received in Athens.
I'm not sure. Let me
set it aside, George.
You think so? Yes, I'm feeling very formal and much semi-well groomed today. You're welcome.
I'm Bill McCarthy. I'm one of the teachers here that's been working on the project. I was kind of wondering actually when you'll be coming to New York so we can kind of get together and talk about what years that we have in mind.
Are you asking me and Greece here? I'm sorry, I was my attention a little better. Well, I'll be probably down in New York late next week. So why don't you drop me an email later this week or early next, and I'll respond, and we'll set up a time and a place.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Surely.
I just say you have to have a round table.
Surely, yes. Yeah,
I won't again.
They have a modular classroom. The kids move and they lay on the floor in Tuscola. And in New York City, desks are rigidly, you know, focused and rolling it out of the floor. And the kids in Denmark were actually thinking in New York about time. And people in New York said, we're working on it. We're working on it.
Yes. Yes.
Our technical person understands it, so once.
Well, no, you're going to be a little bit more passive, but, you know, when we take turns, when I give you the itinerary for the day, basically we'll start off with South Carolina if they come in asking questions. So it's just a question and answer period that will follow the lectures, between the lectures. So we'll have time for some interaction, that it's not just all a discussion straight through. We're going to have a live feed from Harvard University, we hope, from Brown, from here in Greece. There'll be lecturers, and also from Jordan. We're going to start with Jordan as our new partner country, and we're going to do the roll around from Brown University, Harvard, and then here in Greece. And in between those lectures, we're going to have question and answer. That's where it's going to transmit from. Harvard University, are you there? Bill Shea.
Harvard checking in. Can you hear us?
Oh, yes. Wonderful. Welcome.
Yeah, we have Professor Raj here and a few other folks to join us.
Great. This is Athens, Greece.
Wonderful. We wish we were with you there.
Yeah, I miss Boston and Cambridge, so I'm looking forward to coming home. So we'll switch places.
Okay, all right. We'll go offline on the mic now.
Okay. See you soon.
Okay.
South Carolina. Calling South Carolina.
This is J.D.
Someone hung up on us. Jeez. Was it something we said?
Lars
is supposed to be in.
He hasn't dialed yet either.
Okay. So we're missing South Carolina and Denmark.
That's correct.
And someone just dropped off for a moment. We hope for a station break to be back.
I'm going to still try to contact Jed.
Okay, fine, yeah. Because Jed was a little bit, I don't know, he was, when I sent him that message yesterday about the possibility of coming in only by audio. But I sent him an email late saying that it was looking likely the 384 would be viable. So he should be there.
Hi, Jed, you're looking better today.
Thank you.
Yesterday.
Nothing like five cups of coffee.
One more to go.
Three lines make the difference. Audio and everything. We had one line in the first game. The audio from New York was difficult, very difficult.
Now you have permission?
Yes. Well, we're waiting for South Carolina.
How many are there? How many connections
there? There are one in South Carolina, two in New York, one in Denmark, Greece, and Jordan. Harvard University and Brown.
Eight.
He's trying to get South Carolina. I'm gonna call Denmark in the meantime. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Yes. JD. Hello. Yes. Lars is having problems dialing in on that line. Do you have another port for him?
That's the only one still available.
Okay. He said he's getting network problems. Okay. I'll just have him keep trying, okay?
Okay, I still haven't gotten an answer to Britton Smith.
Yeah. I'm surprised. But, maybe they went on an early holiday or something. Anyway, I'll have Lars try that number again.
Okay.
Or maybe he can, well, no, I guess he can't come in a South Carolina port. Okay. Denmark is trying on that port again, JD. So I told him to power down his machine and try booting it up again.
Okay, Joe. I just talked to Jeff. He's turning his equipment on now.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to get underway very soon, folks. So thank you for being patient. Considering the past few days, I guess we're getting a fairly early start. So minor technical difficulties, which will square away hopefully very soon, and we'll all be together. I heard that beep sound. Hello, who just joined us? South Carolina, and we'll wait until they get in, and we'll hope for Denmark, and then we'll begin. New York, you're still with us, correct? Home of the second place Yankees, are you there?
Yes, we are here, and it's only a half a game now, Judge.
Oh, well, I have to come home and save my team.
And we've got Humanities. I see Humanities in there now.
Excellent.
All right.
Good morning, Humanity.
Good morning.
Athens, Greece, checking in. Pardon? Because there's only two sites projecting in New York. They don't project. They only project the one that is speaking to them. Okay? And we're the one. We just hook to them. They have a four-screen system. And the potential for another school in New York to be in that other quadrant. So they get one outside feed in there, and then three of their own, on their own network. I love 384. Everybody at once. Everybody but Lars. Knock on wood.
Hello, Jared.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, then you. What's going on? How's the Dead Sea doing? Still dead?
I was wondering what's going on.
You know, I haven't been studying. I have to apologize. I'm learning Arabic. He is teaching me Arabic. Slowly. Marhaba.
Hello.
Keep Halak.
Keep Halak, too.
Salam alaikum.
Pretty good, huh?
Yeah. You have to say Nia.
Nia. How'd that come through, all right? I love 384.
Thank you, Harry.
It takes some time. It does, a little delay. Much more delay when we go with the one line versus the three.
Jed, are you there? Jed,
okay,
Jed in South Carolina, hello.
Hello.
Jed, wake up. The sun has rise.
Yeah.
Hello. Hello, South Carolina. Check in.
Yeah.
Excellent. Countdown 1 to 10. Or 10 to 1.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome, Britain's next. Boy, you guys look bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, I'll tell you.
Hard to do here.
Hi, Alex. Welcome.
How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. Well, let's wait one more minute for our friend from Sjerslev, Denmark.
Humanities is online.
Welcome, Humanities. Hi, Nigel.
Hi.
We'll begin in 1 minute. Countdown.
Okay.
Yeah, but they're big eighth graders. And they're real mean. Okay, folks. Why don't we settle down, and mute your microphones, please, at all our end points. Everybody find the mute button, just like when the commercials come on TV. This is not a commercial. This is your original programming emanating from Athens, Greece. Live. Okay, thank you. Welcome, everybody. Good morning, USA, New York, South Carolina, North Carolina, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. Thank you for joining us so early in your day. Good afternoon, I hope, Denmark and Jordan, and our partners and friends here in Greece, our host country. Thank you all for attending today. And also a special thanks to our dedicated technical teams who have overcome many problems and issues to bring you all here today. Thank you so much. Today is a very special day for us here at Open and for the age-old noble profession of teaching. Not many times before have so many been gathered from so many places in this way for such an international education experience. We are at the threshold of a new age in education thanks to new technology, and we have a great opportunity before us that we must not let slip from our grasp. From its inception, Open was created as a truly international education program. Its mission is to give equal access to these new technologies for all students and teachers from every culture. Open is designed to field test these amazing technologies for learning and to help develop a new model for education in order to improve our educational systems worldwide, and to better prepare our young students for the difficult challenges the new millennium will bring. But as importantly, Open was founded to allow and promote the free flow of ideas and knowledge,
to give each local community the opportunity to give us all their perspective on issues which affect us all. So let's listen carefully. Open actively promotes the ideals of international exchange and collaboration in order to develop mutual respect and understanding between all peoples of the world and for our precious life-giving planet. Equal access, equal voice, greater understanding. Open is just a baby step, but we hope a positive beginning. We have many more educational programs planned. Topics such as music of the world, preservation of the environment and endangered species, language and communication, human and machine evolution, and the International Space Station and beyond. And we hope you all can join us on our learning expeditions. May the force be with us all. It is in the spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood and the free flow of new knowledge and ideas that I dedicate the open program to the memory and life's work of two exceptional human beings, His Majesty King Hussein and Jenny Constantinou of the Altec Group. King Hussein, we all know, dedicated his life to his people of Jordan and to mediate a peaceful and enduring solution for statehood in the Middle East. Despite formidable obstacles and extremely difficult choices, he was able to help others find some common ground. His statesmanship and commitment to the virtues of peace and understanding will hopefully inspire you and future generations of leaders. Jenny Constantinou gave her life recently in the line of her life's work while setting up a conference for her company in Athens. Jenny was an innocent victim killed by a bomb planted by terrorists. Jenny worked for our partner company, Altec Stat Communications, who has given much to Open over the last year. Jenny was a big supporter of Open and recently participated with our students earlier this semester. She was to be with the Stat Altec team today at our Jordan site. In her life's work, too, Jenny excelled. She inspired her fellow workers and was admired by many for her dedication. People like Jenny inspire us all to give our best in our studies and in our life's work, to strive for excellence and to support one another. When we go forward, Open will set up a scholarship fund for Open students in Jenny's name and in her memory. Thank you, Jenny and King Hussein. And now, our program for today. We are fortunate and honored to have with us today many distinguished guests and world-renowned experts in the fields Open students have studied this semester in archaeology, literature, and history. Our distinguished guest list includes representatives from Open's new partner country, Jordan, and our co-keynote speakers today will be Mr. Akal Biltaji, Minister of Tourism and Antiquities of Jordan, and Dr. Izzat Jaradat, the Minister of Education for Jordan. Excuse me, this will be followed by a short welcome from the director of the Jubilee School from Jordan, Dr. Fadi Jawan. Then we will begin our expert roundtable with Professor Martha Sharp-Jakowski from the Center of Old World Archaeology and Art from Brown University, who will discuss her recent archaeological work and findings in Petra, Jordan. Then Professor Gregory Nagy, chairman of the Classics Department from Harvard University, will discuss the Odyssey and the concepts of the hero. Mr. Nikos Tsouklas of the Hellenic Institute of Marine Archaeology will follow and discuss the Institute's excavations of a 5th century BC shipwreck and show a short film. Finally, we will conclude with a discussion of recent archaeological work in Alexandria Harbor by Mr. Christos Agoudis, also of the Hellenic Institute of Marine Archaeology. And pardon me for butchering everybody's name, by the way. After each lecture, we will take questions from our students for each expert. Due to the sheer number of classes, we'll go in the same orderly fashion. We will start with Britain's Neck, South Carolina first, then Washington Irving from New York, then the Humanities from New York City, then Denmark if they come aboard, Greece, and finally the Jubilee School from Jordan. To keep this moving, we will take one question from each school the first time, then at the end, if we have time, we will open it up for further questions from each school, again in the same order. Please mute when not speaking and speak loudly and slowly and clearly into the microphone. Mr. Biltaji, welcome to Open. Jordan, are you there? Hello, Jordan.
Jordan, I hear loud and clear. How do you read me?
I read you fine. Welcome, Jordan.
And you did not butcher my name at all. You pronounced it very, very well, and I think it was, that was the
great.
Is dedicated for Kingdom Canning. And we are at the Jubilee School, which is started by Kingdom Canning to endure. Let me just read you this quote from the environment news of the UNDP, which I'm sure we can all share. His Majesty wrote in 1962, Jordan itself is a beautiful country. It is wild, with limitless deserts, where the Bedouins roam. The mountains of the north are soft, green forests, and where the Jordan River flows. It is fertile and warm in winter. Jordan has a strange, haunting beauty and a sense of harmony. Jordan, with the ruins of the fire, runs straight. He is the last resort of yesterday, the world of tomorrow. I love each of you. He loves every one of us. He loves the world. He was a man and a king of peace. One of the doubts and the empires is something that Martha, my very good friend, will be talking about later. But let me precede her with a poem on Petra. It seems no work of man's creative hand, by labor wrought as wavering fancy land, but from the rock, as if by magic grown, eternal, silent, beautiful alone. Not virgin white, like the old Doric shrine, where erst Athenant held her rites divine. Not saintly gray, altogether my many a minster fane, that crowns the hill and consecrates the plain, but rose red as if the blush of dawn, that first beheld them up yet the jewels of youth upon a brow of war, which man came old to polish with his own. And he touched a marble, pale in peace and sparkle, a rose in half a dog. So I hope I had
thank you, you did. Excuse me, Brown, would you mind muting your microphone? And other sites, please, so that we can hear the speakers clearly. Thank you.
I continue, and I just glanced Martha there on the screen, and Brown was there. Brown is very much in our heart. Brown is at the heart of Petra, and the season is waiting for Martha, and I think so. We wait for it.
Thank you.
Now, what do I tell you about Jordan? With these five children and the audience, I believe that everybody knows enough about Jordan, but it has always been the trail of the three monotheistic faiths, starting from the journey of Abraham from Ur to the west into Jordan, into Hebron, into Egypt later, and later on into the Hijaz in Saudi Arabia, and back to Hebron. It was also the trail of Moses, with the children of Israel coming back to Sinai, up in Jordan, where Moses was left on the Mount Nebo, buried there, and then the 12 tribes crossed to Palestine, the land of Canaan, the promised land. And it was later on the trail also of Jesus looking for John the Baptist to be baptized in Wadi Harar, in Beit Anya, Bethabara, on the east side of the River Jordan, where Christ was baptized, where Christianity was commissioned, where Father,
Son, and the Holy Spirit for the first time ever. It is also the prayer of Muhammad the Prophet. He was here as a merchant before his message, and he met Bohira, the Mysterian priest in Umar Saad in Mecca. The priest looked at Muhammad, who was a common man of the time, and said, "I see in your eyes somebody that will change the world." Muhammad was a prophet a year later. This is Jordan, the land of the three monotheistic religions, the land of the prayers of faith, the land of peace, the land of King Abdullah Ben Hussein. Have a good day.
Thank you so much, Mr. Taji. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you. George, are you on me?
Thank you, Tom. First, you're doing good. Statement on education and our outlook and our future. One of the good news, pleasure, and also some value and opportunity to obtain some ideas and so. And share with other the number of issues, aspirations, and vision on education for the future. Education enterprise is responsible for living glory in the intellectual guidance in the process of social change. This process places a crucial decisive and transitional phase of what is called the third wave and its implications on developing society, as well as industrial and post-industrial society. Let me start with His Majesty, our most great leader, King Hussein, speech at the Jubilee School ceremony 2 years ago. He referred to the necessity and importance of achieving the real change in the concept of education to cope with the very best of our diverse world, to deepen the values of creativity and initiation, effort, performance, and respect of the spirit of science and knowledge. Today, as we are part of the existing way that proceeds throughout the 23rd century, we cannot be isolated from explaining creation and the outcomes of this advanced technology. Accordingly, Jordan has launched a scientific program to provide information technology capability with education and advice. This program aims to enable students to develop and communicate ideas, to gain and interpret information, to consider, discuss, and evaluate implications for using information technology in life, and to use computers for teaching and learning and communication. Information technology will be developed through an across curricula, textbooks, and school-based activities. Students will be introduced to the International Information Technology Network and its adequate software used in schools through expansion in interdisciplinary data management skills to transfer skills and understanding to other subjects during a 5-year plan. Year 2005. The summit project will link 1,000 secondary schools across the central and local education resources to the kingdom within 3 years' plan. Finally, a future training center based on information technology and technological communication will be established to upgrade the teacher skills and the teaching them skills. This comprehensive program will lead into a quality assurance process in the education enterprise and its objective that will focus on excellence in teaching, creativity in learning, and discipline in teaching, and nothing less than that for Jordan in the name of His Majesty King Abdullah bin Hussein. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jaradab. We look forward to working with you in your school. And now, Dr. Jawan, director of the Jubilee School. Welcome, Dr. Jawan.
Thank you. First of all, in the name of the family of the Jubilee School students and teachers, and on behalf of the executive director of the foundation, Nur Hussain Foundation, the Christina Mahmoud, who was unable to make the salute site at the last moment because of her sickness, I would like to express our thanks and appreciation to the staff of the Open Project, namely you, George, the founder and the director of this project.
Thank you, Dr.
Our thanks also to the staff, Altech, Pitcherton, Southland, and SCI for their coordinated high-tech role in the open program. From our side, a credit should be given to a JCC and their engineers who have been working with the staff to make this event, and really, they did a wonderful job. We at the Jubilee School are proud to be part of the open program. We have been in the picture of this program since maybe 1.5 years, based on instructions from Her Majesty's office and His Excellency the Minister of Education. We are so enthusiastic to cooperate and participate and contribute to this creative idea of the open program, because we feel that it opens a new venues and means for more global cooperation and understanding using this latest technology of communication. Finally, I would like to thank our guests, two distinguished ministers, Dr. Ezzel Jaradab and Mr. Aqil Bintazi. I also would like to thank our students and our teachers who were involved in this program from the beginning, and namely, you know, George, who is motivating and creating the best here, Dima Zeta, you see here, there. I thank you all.
Cheers to everybody in Jordan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jawan. We welcome Jordan and the Jubilee School and many others, and we look forward to a long and prosperous relationship. I guess now is our time for our lectures on the subject areas which the students have studied this semester. We'll begin with Professor Martha Sharp-Jakowski from Brown University, who will give a discussion of her work at the Great Temple and the site, the wonderful site, the beautiful site that I all recommend you go to physically, in person, not virtually, in southern Jordan, in Petra. Martha, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. Yes,
Janie,
excuse me. Yes.
Bill Shea needs to hang up and lay down.
Who does?
Bill Shea.
Okay, Bill.
Bill. Oh,
Bill Shea.
Hello,
Harvard. Okay, great.
Yes, you're still. You're not transmitting any video again this morning.
Excuse me. Give it another try, Harvard, if you could.
You can go back to Brown now.
Okay, Ms. Jakowski, please. You can start. Everybody else, please mute their microphones. And Professor Jakowski, are you there? Hello, Brown University.
George.
Yes. Welcome.
Are we coming, sir?
You sure are.
Well, I want to welcome everybody from the school. Marhaba, Jubilee School. It's lovely to be with you. And in order to save time, we'll digress to a little bit of a discussion about Petra.
Very well.
Here we have a map of modern Jordan that is outlined in red. This is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. And you'll notice that Petra is located in southern Jordan, just above Ayla on the Gulf. The whole area was created by a rift occurring about 100 million years ago. There were several foldings and upheavals. And what you see here is a limestone crest that was formed first. Just below it was formed about 30 million years ago, a sandstone crest. So the indigenous stones to Petra are both limestone, which of course lies higher up as you will see it here, and sandstone, which is easier actually to quarry, and it is the stone of choice used by the Nabataeans to build their city. The Nabataean kingdom, which became prominent in the 2nd century BC, was created from their control of the trade routes. The trade routes extended from Kana in the south up to Marib, from there to Mecca, Medina, Dedan, through Medin Saleh, which is in northwestern Saudi Arabia, on to Ayla, which is just at the mouth of the Red Sea, and then from Ayla on to Petra, and then from Petra to the north to Amman, the capital of Jordan, and from Amman to Damascus, which of course is the capital of Syria. But from Petra, trade routes also went through to the west, to Gaza, and to the Mediterranean. And the Nabataean control of the spices that were carried over this trade route were the origin of the wealth that they amassed during the 2nd century, the 1st century, and until actually Petra and the trade routes were so coveted by the Roman Empire that they were subsumed by the Romans in 106 AD or CE. And we can see how ideas came not only from the East and India, but also close association with Egypt. This is an aerial shot of the mountains around Petra. You can see that there is a natural chasm or declivity in the rock, which has been widened over the years by streams of water flow from the Wadi Musa into the center of the city. It is here that Indiana Jones and his father rode on horseback to find their way to the most illustrious monument known as the Hazne. Now the Hazne, which is also known as the treasury, is thought of as being sort of a perfect Hellenistic monument in the middle of Petra. But it has Nabataean overtones, that is for sure. What you don't see very well here is that the monument is unfinished. Extending from the second order roof, there would have been an obelisk on both sides. We call the second order, or upper order, you can see how the pediment of the temple is broken. This is characteristic of Nabataean architecture, taken from the Hellenistic world, but used by the Nabataeans, particularly in their monuments and their tombs. Is this a tomb? Probably. When was it built? Probably by Aretas IV, who was one of the great kings of Petra and is thought to have been the greatest builder of the city. So now these Nabataeans had amassed a tremendous amount of wealth. And what did they want to do? They wanted to show off. And they built incredibly large structures. This structure supposedly has the same dimensions as Westminster Abbey. You have to think of Indiana coming down through that chasm into the sunlight and seeing the Hazne. Petra has been excavated off and on over the years. And here is a map that is produced by Bachman, and it was also produced by Browning. You can see where Bachman thought a great temple to be, and you see the central street, and then the Temenos area going into the Kasaral Bint. I want to remind you, none of these structures actually exist, except for the Temenos and the Khosrow Bint, which is one of the largest temples, as well as the Temple of the Winged Lions, which is right across the street from the Great Temple. The lower market, the middle market, the upper market have never been excavated. Only 1% of Central Petra has been excavated. And this is why the Brown University excavations have been so important. In 1993, we took a group of aerial photographs. This is what the Great Temple in those days looked like from the air. Perhaps you can see the column fall from the front of the temple, but that's just about it. You can see how the land around the temple area has been built up over its 2,000 years of being buried. Now you can see the same area and what our excavations have produced. After six seasons of working at the Great Temple, you can see that we have well-defined a mammoth structure, which is larger in its precincts than the Khosrow Bint, which lies beside it. Adorning the lower Temenos are as many as 120 columns, and these columns have elephant heads. They're not African elephants, they're Indian elephants. We've already noted obelisks being built into a Hasne. We've already noted Hellenistic ideas in the Hasne. And here we are with a freestanding building with elephant heads adorning the capitals of columns. Her Majesty Queen Noor came to visit us last year, and we were very grateful that she came and took such an interest in our excavations. She spent about an hour with us at the site, and she had a lot of interest in what we were doing and how we were doing it, and we were very grateful.
Well, I think you have an idea of what we've been doing, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Professor Joukowsky. That was a wonderful description. Okay, now we can maybe take some questions from around various schools. Let us begin with South Carolina. Are there any questions, Jed, from your team?
Our question is here with underwater archaeology.
Okay, well, we can hold that. We can hold that till our later lecturers. So
I can't help you.
Well, fortunately for us, Professor Joukowsky, we have the expertise at hand here in Athens. Okay, then let's go on to New York. Any questions from the Washington Irving School for Professor Joukowsky? New York? I know you're not shy in New York. Go ahead, New York.
How long do you think it would take to excavate the whole area?
My plans are to continue, actually, until I finish. Next week I'll be going into the field again, and it just depends on how much we can uncover and record what we uncover in a methodical way. I think it will take 7 to 8 more years of excavation. Come and see us.
Thank you, Professor.
Have students used in excavating? Like, do they help out? Do you let them come and help you excavate the area?
Is your question, do I take students with me? Was that the question I didn't hear you hear? Yes, I do. I take a team of Brown undergraduates as well as graduate students with me.
You have to study real hard.
Well, not only do they have to study hard, but it's very hot in the summer, as you can well imagine. And we have to work during the summer because all of us are teaching during the year.
Excellent question. Okay, how about humanities? Okay, well, has Lars made it in and his team from Denmark?
Not able to get in, Bill.
Okay. Then we'll go to the school that has probably has the most knowledge, Petra.
the students from the Jubilee School. Any questions from Jubilee?
No.
Oh, I guess you know it all. Okay.
Hello.
I'm sorry. Okay. All right. Let's back up. Let's back up a little bit. It looks like the humanities has come back into the picture here. So let's take a question from the humanities school who are waving their arms frantically. Humanities, go ahead. Everybody else mute their microphones, please.
Hello, can you hear us yet? Hello?
Yes, Nigel, go ahead.
Okay, the person who's controlling the computer is the one that wants to ask the question, so you can just hold on.
Sure.
Hello?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to know what type of tools you would use to build the monument.
Numerous studies of Navajian tools. One thing that people don't really realize about Petra is that every surface that was decorated was also plastered. And the Navajians used a tool that's shaped like a fork, a flat fork, and they did what we call dressed their stones so that there would be a firm footing provided by the stone for the plaster. Now, when you look at our temple, or you look at the Hasna, or any of the major monuments of Petra, you see them as sandstone today. But in antiquity, they used these tooth-like tools, and of course they used chisels, and most of the reason that they dressed the stones in the way they did was to hold the plaster, which wasn't just white. It was white and red. You have to think of Petra as being a very colorful place in antiquity.
Thank
you. Question? Is there any meaning to the Indian elephant on the monument?
You know, we don't know. I would like to hear your ideas. Why would the Navajians celebrate the Asian elephant? It really is quite curious. There's no elephant-headed capital, I think, that I certainly know of, in the classical world. Why did the Navajians select the elephant as sort of a logo for this building in Petra? It's very curious to all of us. But if you have any ideas, we'd be happy to hear them.
And we have Martha's email. She only received 17 this morning, so I think she has room in her computer for many more.
But I'm leaving. I'm leaving to excavate on June 1.
No computer access from Petra, I take it.
No, unfortunately. So come and see me. Ahlen.
Okay, let's move on to another school. Thank you. We're going to make another round back to you at some point. We can have a further discussion, but we'll give everybody a chance. How about Athens here? Everybody else mute their microphone, please. Any questions from the room here? On Petra? Yeah, all right. We have a question here.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
You said before there was an Hellenistic character in their art, in their temple. What kind of contact was between Nabataeans and Greeks?
I'm sure that there was a great deal more contact than that which we know about. Don't forget that Nabataean trade route went through also to Gaza. And the Mediterranean is just like a big world of contact from culture to culture. So I am sure that not only in the aftermath of Alexander the Great's death and the carving up of the empire and the Seleucids and also the Ptolemies, and the building of Alexandria probably greatly influenced Petra. One of the great architectural historians who has done an enormous amount of work on Petra is now writing a book on Alexandria. And we see that many of the same techniques are used, are brought from Alexandria to Petra.
Thank you.
Dr. Zawotsi, Petra in Greek means stone. Is that
right.
The ancient name of the city of Petra?
The ancient name, excuse me.
Someone else is speaking with a, could they mute their microphone? Everybody mute their microphone so we can hear Professor Joukowsky's answer. Thank you.
Sorry.
The biblical name is Sela, S-E-L-A. And Petra was really named by Hadrian, the Emperor Hadrian, who called it Petra Hadriana, after himself, of course. So he used the Greek word and so named the site.
Okay, because Petra in Greek means stone.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay, it is a Greek word.
Okay, in the effort of trying to keep this rolling and give everybody a chance, we'll have to go to the Jubilee School. Any folks down there have a question for Professor Joukowsky? Jubilee?
Morning, Professor.
Merhaba. Merhaba. Who recorded the film?
There is information that I know that says that Petra monuments are carved from top to the bottom. So why is that?
Probably, I don't think that that's always the rule, but most of the time we think that it is. You can see the unfinished tomb at Petra, which is finished on the top and isn't finished on the bottom. However, look again at the treasury, and you will see that they carved from top to bottom, but they were also going up. They didn't finish it. So it depends on the monument. But by and large, we can see that they had more interest in finishing the cornices, the tops of the monuments, and then working their way down.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Okay, any more questions from Jubilee?
Hello?
Hello?
How are you? I want to ask you about Qasr al-Bunayt. Why do you think it was the only building that they built it, not further?
Well, that's what we have with the Great Temple as well. It is a freestanding building. And most of central Petra was freestanding. We're sure that this was where the Great Temple is located and where the castle is located, is the most important, the most sacred center of Petra. And the land and the way the city lies really indicated that A, they had to build on either side of the Wadi Musa, because the Wadi Musa bisects the city, and if they were going to build monumental buildings, they had to be freestanding. Because in back of our temple is the El Kazute Ridge, which would not have produced a very tall and imposing building. So they had to rely on freestanding structures for central Petra.
Thank you very much. Excellent information. Okay, I think for the sake of time, we have thank you very much, Professor Joukowsky, and we wish you the best in your work at the Great Temple this summer. Have a safe trip to Jordan, and say hello to my friends there for me. Okay, one last question.
I'll show them around.
One last question, Professor Joukowsky, from our friends from South Carolina. Jed, go ahead.
Professor, where does the funding come from for the excavations?
I'm sorry, dear, what did you say?
Where does the funding come from for your excavations?
Oh, there are numerous foundations that we approach to help us finance the excavations. Brown University helped enormously. The Jordanian Department of Antiquities have also helped us by providing us with trucks for soil removal, etc. It's a group of people, both Americans, some international donors. We have one donor from Saudi Arabia, as well as the Jordanian government. This is very much, in every sense of the word, a collaborative international project, just as OPEN is this morning. Good question.
Thank you, South Carolina. Yes. Yes.
I just want to ask you all about and what Senator Martin is doing within the and Pro-Hospital Farms is also funding Brown University program. I believe there's some $50,000 coming through, so Martin should be looking for it as well.
Great news.
I want to say that one of the responsibilities that we as archaeologists have is how we leave the site once we have finished excavation. And the money from the American Express Company are being directed only toward the consolidation of the site so that it is a welcome place for visitors. And will be part of the tourist attraction of Petra.
They promised to triple and quadruple that. I got that from the Harvey Gallup, so work on it before you come over.
Inshallah.
Shukran. Okay, we must move on. It's time that if we could move to Harvard University to Professor Naj. In New York City, would you mind muting your microphones? You're interrupting some of the discussion, so if you could please, when you're not speaking, mute your microphones, New York. Thank you. Harvard University, are you there?
Yes, we're here. Can you hear me, George?
I can, Professor Naj. Welcome.
Well, I'm so happy to be here. I'd like to introduce some of the people I'm with. But I'll introduce myself first so people can know who's speaking to them. My name is Gregory Naj, and I'm a professor of ancient Greek at Harvard University. And to my left, there's Bill Shea, and then Jim Holt, and they are at the Center for Basic Research in the Social Sciences at Harvard. And then to my immediate left is Tom Jenkins, who is a head teaching fellow at the Classics Department of Harvard University. And to my right is John Wilbanks of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And all of us are very much interested in and supportive of the wonderful work that you are doing, George, and the wonderful work of OPEN. And I'm happy to talk for about 5 minutes, no more than 5 minutes, about the concept of the hero in the Odyssey, since I know that the students have been reading about the Odyssey and from the Odyssey. And everybody has just heard important things from Professor Joukowsky concerning the relevance of Petra to our enterprise. And I would like to connect with an observation that she and previous speakers have made about the importance of the idea of journey. Because if we understand the idea of journey, we understand the basic element in the concept of the ancient Greek hero. We also saw the idea of journey linked with the three major religions of the modern world, the three of the major ones. Okay, so I'll take some time out and we'll repeat that.
Gregory? This is George. You're not coming through visually. We can hear you very clearly. J.D., is there some difficulty with the video from Harvard still?
They're going to have to dial right back in, and you'll see if there's a frame up.
Okay. Give it a try again, Harvard. Sorry about this, people, but it's the nature of the technology. We're only a step along the path. New York, could you mute your microphones, New York, please?
Are we back?
Yep. Just count down from 10, please, and we'll see if we can have you come in.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5.
Oh, we
four.
Have you. Wonderful.
Wonderful. Bravo.
Hey, welcome, Harvard. Excellent.
We left off with three of the major religions of the world, and how in Jordan we see stories of journeys that focus on those three major religions. That gives you an idea of the importance of journey, and as I was saying earlier, a journey as a way of defining the ancient Greek hero. In the Odyssey, the journeys of Odysseus are what make him a hero. This is a very different kind of hero from the hero of the other great Homeric epic, the Iliad, in the sense that this hero achieves his heroic status, his prestige and his essence as a hero, by way of journeying, by way of leaving the martial fields of Troy and trying to go back home. I'd like to focus on some specific themes in the Odyssey as a way of trying to come to terms with this important aspect of the hero. One scene, which is maybe the easiest scene to start with, is when Odysseus is in disguise. Nobody recognizes him yet in Ithaca, his homeland. Suddenly comes upon his old dog. The dog is so old that he has lost all of his senses, except maybe the sense of smell. And the recognition that happens between the dog and the master is, in a sense, the way a journey can come to a conclusion that really means something. It's a recognition scene, maybe not the way Aristotle thought of recognition scenes, because this is a very primal recognition scene through the sense of smell, maybe the most basic of all the senses. But nevertheless, it is a way for the hero coming back from Troy to Ithaca to achieve his identity in terms of coming home. A journey is never or very seldom a straight line from point A to B. There's zigzags. And that's what the Odyssey is all about. Which brings me to the second of the moments in the Odyssey that I'd like to explore with you. This one is the cave of the cannibal monster Polyphemus, where Odysseus, in order to get away with his life, denies his identity. It's like the game of snakes and ladders. By denying your identity, you essentially go back to point zero. All the accomplishments that you may have made, let's say, as a warrior at Troy, are canceled, and you have to start all over again. Then Odysseus escapes with his life from the cave of the monster Polyphemus, the Cyclops. Essentially, he has to start all over again, and that starting all over again is the most important aspect of his journey. There are also more complicated aspects of this zigzagging. One of my favorites is perhaps the most unconventional journey of the Odyssey, and that is when Odysseus is getting away from the island of Calypso. You would think he'd like to stay there because he has guaranteed immortality, or so he thinks. Yet his instincts propel him towards home. When he does finally sail away from the island of Calypso, he does not do it conventionally. on a ship sailing in the daytime. He is lying flat on his back, floating along on a raft, a makeshift raft, and he is floating at night, which is something that Greek sailors or sailors in the Mediterranean don't like to do. It's dangerous. And what is he doing as he's floating on a raft, lying on his back? He is looking up at the skies, and he sees the constellation, what we call the Big Dipper, but what they called the Wagon, or the Bear Star. And as he's looking at those pictures that are transmitted to him by the stars, because for the ancients, stars are not only a means of navigation, they're a means of giving a meaning to life. He, the mariner, the navigator, is trying to figure out what it will take for him to get home. And reading the constellations, reading the stars, gives him ideas about not only how to make it back home, but what are the dangers. What were even the dangers of the island of Calypso? Because it turns out the stars tell him that maybe the immortal life that he thought he would have is really not that at all. Since the story that the stars tell is about how a mortal falls in love with an immortal female and in the end dies for it. I should end my moments of the Odyssey with the meeting between Odysseus and his wife, Penelope, and then the meeting between Odysseus and his father, Laertes. Both of these meetings bring to a sense of closure the journey of a hero, in the sense that he finally gets reintegrated and re-identified with those he loves more than anybody else in his life. Homecoming, therefore, is a matter of reconnection, of connecting with all the things that make you the person that you are. And the Odyssey, as a story of a hero, concentrates on this heroic reconnection, which is something to which all of us can connect, emotionally as well as intellectually. Before I end, I want to make a comment on how Homeric poetry, not just the Odyssey, but the Iliad as well, help us connect with our own lives. And I think the easiest way to illustrate this is to think of Alexander the Great and what Homer and the heroic stories of Homer, especially of Achilles and Odysseus, meant to him. There's a very important myth which followers of Alexander propagated about Alexander, which perhaps captures the ambitions of Alexander the Great and the ambitions of Greek civilization. And that is how Alexander used to keep a copy of Homer in a box. The box was called the Narthex. In some versions it's just the Iliad, in other versions it seems that it's both the Iliad and the Odyssey. And every time he went to bed, he had this box of the Iliad and the Odyssey, or let's say a box of Homeric poetry, under his headrest. I like to say headrest rather than pillow, because I imagine the location of the Homeric text simply under his head. That's the point of the myth. So, there's Homer under his bed, and sure enough, in the Alexandrian tradition, this is not necessarily history, but it's myth, which can be treated as a historical blueprint of what people really thought about their importance. In this myth, one night Alexander is sleeping, there's a text of Homer under his head, and he dreams that there's an old man with white hair and a white beard who comes to him and tells him to found the city of Alexandria, which will turn out to be the keystone for the continuation of Greek civilization and a continuation for the concept of the hero and the important and immortal stories about how a hero's journey of the soul will lead to self-recognition and understanding of humanity. George, did you hear all of that? And did the people who are connected to us and open hear most of my words?
we heard all the words. We had a little staggering of the video, but that was okay. It wasn't too distracting. Your words spoke volumes, and we enjoyed them very much in Athens, and I hope all the other sites were able to hear them as clearly as we were. Thank you very much, Professor Nash, for that lovely discussion on the Odyssey and the Journey of the Hero. I guess quickly we'll take a round of questions. If we could begin again with South Carolina, if they have questions. South Carolina, are you there still?
Come back, those stores.
Okay, keep going. Their expertise is on underwater archaeology, which we'll be getting to in a moment. Next off, New York. In New York schools, I think Washington Irving had some work on the Odyssey, and their studies were open this semester. So are there any questions for Professor Nash?
Yeah. Morning. How was Alexandria the keystone of later Greek civilization?
That's a very good question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. When Alexander the Great founded the city of Alexandria, he meant it as a rival of such great centers of civilization as Athens. I think it's very important that the location of Alexandria is not in Europe, and it was conceived of as not in Europe, but in Africa. And what Alexander was trying to do is translate the ideals of Hellenic culture into a world that goes beyond narrow views of what it is to be European, which were views that were perpetuated by certain kinds of myths. There were rival myths that emphasized the universalism of the Hellenic tradition. And so such cities as Alexandria in Egypt and Pergamon in Asia Minor were important new outposts of a bigger and even more embracing view of what it is to be Greek, which is to be universally humane. And that is why I went out of my way to say that Alexandria in Egypt, as this very important center of Greek civilization, is in Egypt, just as Pergamon, as another important new rival center, is in Asia, and was understood to be in Asia. I hope that answered your question.
There's one more question. Are there any modern books that could compare to the Odyssey? If not, why?
I think there are many, many works that can be compared to the Odyssey because the idea of the journey of a soul has been explored by so many minds from so many different cultures. And we don't just have to think of obvious allusions to the Homeric Odyssey, such as James Joyce's Ulysses. There are many other works that have no direct references to either Homer or the Odyssey, or even the name of Odysseus, that I would say would be comparable. I have my own favorites. Perhaps the best one for me is the poetry of Walt Whitman, especially when Whitman explores the idea of a journey, of a crossing over from one state of thinking to another state of thinking and feeling. I think especially of the poem Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, which I recommend to you warmly. I think if you read that poem, you see perhaps better than anywhere else what it is to be an American, a kind of American odyssey, an American journey of the soul.
Thank you, Professor Nash, very much. And great questions. Any other questions that we can continue with from New York or maybe Jordan or Athens here.
Hello?
Yes.
I have a question for the professor. What are the evidences that Homer was the author of the versus compilation of other authors? Or, yeah.
Beautiful question. It has taxed the minds of many an expert in the ancient classics,
I do not presume to give any kind of final answer, but what I can offer you is a kind of cumulative formulation of what Greek civilization thinks the author, thinks about the author who is Homer. As far as Greek civilization is concerned, Homer, the poet, is not only the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey, but by virtue of that is the originator of everything that it takes to be civilized. Only one author shares in getting credit for this kind of authorship, and that is Hesiod. If you look at Herodotus, the so-called father of history, he spells it out in book two of his history, where he says that between the two of them, Homer and Hesiod, have said everything that needs to be said about what it takes to be civilized. So I figure if a late 5th century author says that about Homer, whether we think this way or that way about who the historical Homer was, that's almost immaterial. But that cultural statement about the importance of Homer is good enough for me, and it's good enough for me to understand that if you read the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, and if you read the Theogony and Works and Days of Hesiod, you have essentially what a 5th century Greek would say is what it takes to be civilized. So just four verses, and if you master those, you're a civilized person.
I highly recommend it for everybody in Open. Thank you, Professor Nash. Okay, any questions further on to maybe Athens here? And, yeah, one question, want to come up?
In this story, is there a moral,
whatever? Oh, boy, that's a very good question. Could I go from what is sometimes called high art, like Homeric poetry, to what is sometimes called low art, like the fables of Aesop? When we are exposed to the fables of Aesop, we're very used to the ending of the fable, which conventionally says, and the moral of the story is. But you know, the interesting thing is that in the ancient world, that was the part that did not need to be said, because a fable is supposed to be a challenge to our intellect, a challenge also to our morality and to our sense of affection, in other words, our capacity to use our emotions. Put it another way, the fables of Aesop and the Odyssey of Homer, on different levels, challenge our intellectual, moral, and emotional capacities. And in a sense, we're the ones who are supposed to provide the moral of the story. The story doesn't spell it out. The moral has to be struggled for by us. And believe it or not, and this is the best part, that struggle where we try to understand what the meaning of the Odyssey is, what the moral of the Aesopic fable is, that struggle to understand, that struggle to grasp both intellectually and in other ways, including emotionally and morally, that struggle is a journey, and it is a journey of the soul, and it is an odyssey. You can spell it with a capital O or a lowercase O, as we often do. And every one of us has that odyssey.
Thank you, Professor Nash. Wonderful answer. Jubilee, quickly, if you have a question, we want to give you a fair opportunity.
Yes, I have a question here from Jones. I'd like to ask, when did the concept of immortality enter into Greek mythology?
A beautiful question. In the 19th century, Erwin Rohde, R-O-H-D-E, who was a friend of Nietzsche, thought that the concept of immortality is something that creeps into Greek poetry gradually. More recent thinking, however, has come up with an even more interesting possibility, which is that the concept of immortality was always there. The idea that a hero is going to be reborn after death is there, but this concept is so religious, and in Greek terms, therefore, so local,
that it couldn't be expressed in a universalized kind of way. It's easier to talk about death because the way we die, all of us, is not culture specific. Everybody goes through the same ordeals, the same kinds of ordeals in dying. But when it comes to rebirth after death, almost every local community had a different version of what happens, what it takes, what are the qualifications for rebirth after death, what are the ordeals that the soul goes through in the journey from death to rebirth. You see, that too is a journey. And because there were so many local variations, so much local color, it was easier for universal media like Homeric poetry to shade over the details of what it is like to be reborn after death, and to highlight those aspects of the human experience that can be talked about across boundaries of religion. In a curious way, the Odyssey, however, does give you a blueprint of what it's like to be reborn after death. And if I can just take 30 seconds, this question of yours is so good. Think of the fact that Odysseus, when he's sailing back from Troy, travels further and further west. And by the time he reaches the island of Circe, he's in the far west. That's where the sun sets. And in the concept of the universe, where the earth is round and flat, the idea of sunset is that the sun goes down into a cosmic river and then comes up out of the same cosmic river on the other side, in the far east. It fascinates me that in the Odyssey, after Odysseus goes down to Hades, and after he visits the souls of the dead, and thus has his own journey of a soul, after that, when he comes back up, and he's still at the island of Circe, the island of Circe is no longer in the far west. It's explicitly set to be in the far east. That is to say, just as the setting sun is in the far west, but finds itself in the far east the morning after, so also in the Odyssey, if you look at book 12 at the very beginning, when Odysseus comes up for air, so to speak, when he comes back from Hades, he is now in the far east, where the dawn goddess dances. That's the way the Odyssey puts it. It's still the island of Circe, which used to be in the far west, but now is in the far east. But it's, in a mystical way, the same place. It's no accident that Circe, Circe, does seem to mean womb, coming full circle. So thank you for that very engaging question. I hope I didn't take too long in giving you a tentative answer.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excellent. We're going to have people going to go over a little bit, and I apologize because we've had such an engaging discussion, and I apologize to my team here in Athens who've waited so patiently for their turn. Thank you, Professor Naj. It was wonderful, and I look forward to seeing you back in Boston when I get home this weekend. I have Nikos Tsoukalos. Yes.
This is Jay George.
Yes.
The conference is going to end in less than 10 minutes.
Okay.
Hello? If you'd like, I can build another conference immediately after this one. It'll
okay.
take about 5+ minutes to rebuild it.
Okay.
And everybody will have to dial back in, if you would like.
If that would be all right, I'd like to give everybody a fair chance here. And if that's okay with the schools and the far end points, and if we could just go over a little bit here in Athens, is it okay for us to stay a little later?
Oh, 3 minutes.
Yeah. So JD, we'll do that when the signal drops. If we could all just dial in once more, to the same numbers, JD.
Hopefully so. Okay. We may change, but try the same number.
Okay.
If you have any problems, just pardon.
Okay, we will. And all right, thank you, JD, and I apologize everybody for this extension, but I think it's worth enough of our time and effort to. Be patient and stay with it. Okay? You can go. Yes.
5 minutes. I will give you some general information about the Koch. The Koch is both an island and the code name of the find we have there. The Kos is an island which is on the eastern side of Peloponnesus, some 50 miles away in the south of Athens. And it's a small island, uninhabited. It has a big inlet and a smaller inlet on its side where we have the most, the oldest wreck site known in the world to this day. It dates sometime in 2200 BC. Or if you like better, 4,200 years from today. This wreck, this site was discovered by late Peter Throckmorton in 1975. And we first went there the autumn of 1975, but then we had a long time to wait until we could proceed to the excavation. And we started excavating the site in 1989, and it took us 4 years. We were working 2 months every year, two and a half months every year, in a depth of about 40 to 35 meters. The wreck site was rather extended. It was something like 600 square meters. And we believe we had not a normal wreck there, maybe a capsized or a broken ship to spread all its cargo in this large area. We had lots of problems in our excavation because I told you we were in an inhabited island with no water, no electricity, no food, no supermarkets, I mean, no communication. So we had to provide everything for ourselves. And so we had electric plants, we had radio telephones, everything you need for 30, 40 people to live 2 months there. And of course, we had the communication, arranged our own communication to bring things and send things. And to bring people and people going and coming. So we had to be able to communicate with other islands of the mainland. This particular wreck, there are many problems and many thoughts about it, and it has been a quite difficult wreck to dig. I mean, about archaeological points, the archaeological information, it will be given to you after me by Christos Aguirre. One thing I would like to stress, that we used modern techniques, which have not been used up to that time. We had to record the ship with an experimental system. It's invented in the United States. And we are the first who used it. I mean, they have used it only experimentally, not in real sites. They were setting sites to test it. But we tested it. It was the SHARPS, which is called, the acronym of, what's the acronym? Sonic high accuracy ranging and positioning system, which helped a lot with its accuracy to have the drawings, let's say, to have the position of every find on the bottom. And that was, first of all, it was very fast. Even if we had to proceed with traditional methods, it would take us 9 times more than with the shafts.
JD, excuse me, Nikos. JD, how close are we from shutdown?
It's just another hour. We shouldn't have to drop out at all.
Oh, wonderful.
We've got to extend it out another hour.
That's good news. Okay.
Yes, you can see some scenes of the excavation by the video we have made of the. And I will speak on the video so you can. Will I see the video myself?
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be on the screen.
You have the mouth on. Right.